Today I'm very excited to welcome onto Radio Gorgeous a woman who is a journalist, broadcaster and author who writes regularly about civil liberties, censorship issues and gender politics for The Guardian, Vice and The Telegraph. She's a regular on BBC Two, Radio 2's Jeremy Vine show and Woman's Hour. She makes frequent appearances in the media talking about sex, porn and society. This is her second book. She is Nikki Hodgson and she is the director of the Ethical Partnership. And today we're going to talk about the curious history of dating from Jane Austen to Tinder, which has just come out. Very warm welcome to Radio Gorgeous. Hi, Nikki.
Hiya. Thanks, Josephine.
So let's start at the beginning. Let's start with Jane Austen times. How easy was it to get a man then?
Well, it depended whereabouts you were in society. You know, the pecking order was everything. So if you were middle class, you had more opportunity because you had more money and you could have more active social life. You could go to balls, you could go to parties, and you could also place Lonely Hearts adverts, which the Georgians were completely enamoured with.
So not dissimilar to now in that way, but you put an advert in. Yeah, where would you put it into?
So in Regency England, there were these matrimonial gazettes that used to circulate. And the way you would put an advert in was by sending a trusted male envoy with your little description to one of the coffee houses in London, where all the salacious things happened. And there would be a mailbox set up for you, and you would have to rely on this male envoy to fetch and carry your replies and messages back and forth. But these were widely in circulation, and men and women posted in them equally. And the other thing that's really fascinated me about them is that the women were very straightforward about what they were looking for in them. So, you know, they would stipulate how much money they had a year, you know, something like, I have 5,000 a year, you need to have 10,000 a year. There is a property in our family which we'll eventually inherit, you know, God willing, and I'm of a sweet and demure manner. And they just really, you know, quite succinctly get to the point. And, you know, it's really important to remember that at that time, women couldn't inherit property. And whomever they married, anything they owned became the property of their husband. Even their children were technically the property of their husband. So it was really, really important to make a good match and make sure that the guy you'd gone after wasn't a cad. So
if you did marry a cad, you couldn't even divorce, could you? You'd be ripped off. That would be
no. It was just a terrible end to your life. So it was incredibly important that women's rights were protected within marriage, and this became a really pressing issue in the 19th century. Campaigners started to figure out that this mattered. But that was also the time when people started to elope to Gretna Green, because if you were really in love with somebody, regardless if they were a cad, you could go and get married there without your parents' permission. And I think that's what happens in... they don't run off to Gretna Green, but they elope. That's what happens in Pride and Prejudice with Lydia, the youngest daughter, when she runs off with... Is it Mr. Wickham? I forget his name. But he's one of the caddish sergeants that they meet at a ball. So that was actually quite a common occurrence, was to run off with your naughty lover. Well, so, yeah.
So, people, I think it sounds like people were kind of more businesslike about marriage, weren't they, really?
They absolutely were, and that's because they hadn't yet become attached to the idea of romantic love within marriage. That was a Victorian invention, very much. And when Queen Victoria met Prince Albert, it transformed people's perception of relationships, because she openly declared being wildly in love with him, and she proposed to him. So it sort of, it changed the game slightly. And, the Victorians were just, they invented so many of our modern day rituals around love. So they invented the Valentine's card. The invention of the penny post meant that people could write love letters to one another. They loved floriography, sending symbols of love and, you know, passion in flowers. They also loved these things called... I think they were called carte postales. They were little photographs that you would have, that you would take of yourself, but of other people, and which you could purchase of royals or celebrities of the day. And then you could put them, stick them into these little albums and share them with other people. And the idea was that you were sending messages about who you were and where you wanted to be in society and what you might get up to after you were married by sharing them with people. So it's kind of like the Victorian Instagram. But yeah, they were heavily in favour of romantic love, and they could afford to be, because many of them, at the top end at least of society, were, you know, reaping the benefits of the Industrial Revolution. You know, there was finally money for lower middle class people as well as upper middle class. It didn't matter so much if you had a title anymore. So that enabled them to stop focusing on the economic benefits of marriage so much.
Because there was more money around.
Because there was more money around, exactly. Yeah. And it still hadn't shaken up at all, really, but class was starting to be seen in slightly different ways. Like the merchant class was changing the notion of, you know, the pecking order, and you know, there was prosperity in towns in the north, which there hadn't been, you know. So it was really changing the movement of money, and then that changed what people could do socially.
Really interested in the book that you say that if a can you explain about class and marriage, what happens to your status if a woman marries below or a man marries above?
Yeah, so you take on your husband's status by and large. So that's why it's so important for women to marry well and not so much men. Or it actually means a slightly different thing. So men would go to great lengths to emphasize their wealth and their connections. Women actually tended to protect theirs a little bit and slightly downplay them because they didn't want to be taken advantage of. And I think that probably still applies, not necessarily in Britain today, but there's definitely a lot of places in the world where that's absolutely...
So what would happen is, so if I married someone in a class below, I would go down to his class.
Yes, absolutely.
So I would lose my status. So I can really see why that was important.
Yeah, it was just, it was vital. And, you know, this thing of, I think there was a sort of seminal case in the 19th century when one of the very important aristocrats at the time campaigned to have her children with her when she divorced her husband. And then that changed the notion of who owned children and who needed to look after children. Up until that point, it had been the husbands that took charge of their children, if you know, no matter what their wives got up to. So again, you still needed to have a really good family circle around you to enable you to look after your children if you were left or you did want to leave your husband. And in the Victorian era, there's still a huge amount of shame about doing that.
It's been unacceptable, really, until the 1970s in Britain.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hang on, I just want to ask about dancers, because they obviously were the place where you met someone. Can you tell us the etiquette of a dance, what would happen?
Yeah, so in Regency England, again, as I said before, it tended to be middle-class women and men that would go to these dances. If your family could afford, you could have a coming-out season as a debutante in London. It started as far back as then. And there was a short period of about 3 months where you just had to hammer it. You had to go to every party you were invited to, every dance you were invited to. And, you know, it was considered a marriage mark, basically. That was your one chance. And once you got to a ball, there was very strict etiquette about how you could interact with the men there. So they had to be introduced to you, I think, rather than the other way around. You absolutely had to have a female chaperone. You couldn't call each other by your first names.
Wow.
And you couldn't, if you refused one man for a dance, you had to refuse every man, because you weren't to be seen giving particular attentions to any gentleman, in, you know, that would give people, you know, the wrong idea. And also you had to hedge your bets, so you really had to try not to give your game away. So in the early Georgian period, fans were really important, because you could convey things through fluttering your fan, and it also really was designed to kind of hide your blushes and try. It was a way of trying to keep your emotions hidden from anybody that might misinterpret them. You couldn't dance without gloves on. You could only touch fingers through gloves. And you know, there were rituals about who was allowed to collect your fur or your cloak at the end of the evening, and then communication following that was heavily prescribed. Letters were the only way of declaring feelings, and if you got to the stage where you were properly interested in somebody as a guy, you had to write to the parents separately. And there were all these etiquette manuals of the day and these letter writing guys, and the letter writing guys are themselves etiquette manuals, because you know the letters they suggest are basically telling you what the social convention is and exactly how you phrase asking for somebody's hand in marriage, for example. You know, there was there were strict rules around it. So it was really quite a palaver.
Palaver, but also it was how the hell did you get who you wanted? Sounds really difficult.
Yeah, well, I think you didn't. I think, you know, the criteria was different. And you couldn't be too picky. You had to be picky about the right things. You had to be picky about, you know, somebody's future financial plans. Quite a common thing for men on the make who might have been working class and were trying to ascend, even though they didn't really during that time, would be to list, you know, give extensive business plans in their letters to their potential father-in-laws to prove that they were going somewhere.
And that must be still why it's traditional that the fiancé goes and asks for your hand in marriage from the father.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, the idea that when women were men's property, you couldn't just take the property, you had to go ask permission to alleviate somebody of it.
Wow, it's so, so interesting. So I found it very amusing in the book that men would find it very difficult to find out what age a woman was, because obviously it was, again, the etiquette, you couldn't ask what age somebody was.
No, you couldn't. And again, it was, you know, it was really important because, and people still have it today, a thing about their age, but this idea of being a potential old wife or being past your best. There was an etiquette guide of the day that said something along the lines of, you know, you don't need to worry too much about getting too old because a woman at 29, you know, kind of grown into her beauty and be much more beautiful at 19. But the way the Georgians interpreted this was, oh, you've got a 10-year window and you want to try and marry yourself off young so your husband is happy for the next decade as you get older and while you have your children.
But I suppose that also people were so scared of being left on the shelf. I mean, what age were you left on the shelf?
I think probably about 35.
Gosh, so it's not as bad as I thought.
It's not as young as we think. Mm. And funnily enough, the age of first marriage has fluctuated over the years. It hasn't just gone up and up and up. Mm. It's changed according to economic situation in the country, according to wartime, according to all sorts of other factors. But actually in Georgian England, people could afford to wait a few years to get married. They were just so keen and so concerned to make a good match rather than an early match.
Wow, it's really intriguing. Also remember, one in two women died in childbirth, so there must have been a lot of deaths. So we're kind of widowers looking, all age groups kind of busy at times.
Yeah, absolutely. And people did, you know, they created their own version of blended families, as we call them today, eventually. But, you know, and that's part of the reason why it was so important to sort out women's inheritance rights, because it was a bit like how Sharia operates today, or, you know, the idea that if you had multiple wives or had multiple wives or multiple children, like how did you carve up your estate in the event of death or when you did die, when they needed things? So again, yeah, that the beginning of women being able to inherit their own objects, property, wealth was really, really important for the decisions they could then make. It gave them a huge amount of freedom, actually, past that point. They didn't have to worry quite so much about their husband running off with their wealth.
Now let's go on to the Edwardians now. They seem to have a bit more fun than everybody else.
Yeah, the Edwardians, I think, had quite a good time by and large. And that was partly to do with the king at the time, who was a bit of a playboy and was known for that. And he had such a great party scene in London and kind of up and down the country at the various races. And whatever the royalty was doing in the time period, you know, they were the ultimate celebs of the day, so their behaviour really influenced what everybody else thought they could get up to. The other thing about the Edwardians is that they were the target of the Buccaneer Brides, which were the women who came over from East Coast America with lots of money. Actually, they were usually very well educated, well spoken, could dance, beautifully dressed. And they sought out the heirs of crumbling estates in Britain. So,
because they got a title and an, you know,
yeah, it was a really great exchange for them. We needed the money, and they needed the class system. So that there was an influx of American brides in that era, and then for everybody else, you know, for the working people, industrialization had changed who you could visit or who you could meet. So you had this, you know, once the railway was in operation, that really influenced where you could go and what you could get up to. It was the first time that women had been in close confinement with men on public transport, you know, and the invention of the bicycle as well, really, really important for women's liberation, because they didn't need chaperones anymore.
Why did the chaperone stop?
Well, apparently, like, a chaperone couldn't really keep up to you. And the other thing is that women had been allowed to ride tricycles, which were purposefully, they were purposefully encouraged to ride them because they could
have a long skirt.
They could have the long skirts, and then the bicycle changed that. And it sounds like a really trivial thing right now, but to have never seen women in trousers, and then suddenly to see them doing that,
they
would
have
been quite mind-blowing.
They were like kind of baggy, divided bloomer sort of things,
yeah,
weren't they?
They would have worn bloomers. But it was the fact that they could go out on midnight cycles, you know, with lovers, which they did do. And taking a bicycle to the seaside was a really common thing. So there were these kind of burgeoning new means of freedom for people.
And kind of feminists started around that time as
well,
didn't they?
I mean, that's why the bicycle was really criticised when it was first.
Well, it was very racy, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. And it was the new woman who was the woman that wore bloomers, yeah, smoked.
A bit of a Gibson girl.
Exactly, yeah. Didn't need a man and all that, who was riding it.
Yeah. It was the first time it was ever sports clothes for women, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. And the Victorians had a sense, you know, despite that sort of urban myth that Queen Victoria thought lesbians didn't exist, refused to believe they existed. That's not actually what happened. There was some kind of weird thing in Parliament where they, you know, they sort of said to me, you don't really want to write this into the statute books. But there was this growing panic about women not needing men and women running off with other women, which kind of came to fruition after the First World War.
Well, definitely, because there weren't enough men around.
Absolutely. And young women could... Women that had never been able to work could finally work. Younger women moved into cities. They took jobs as shop workers, as secretaries, as journalists. And they had their own income, and they lived in digs with other women. There had been some restriction on licensing in music halls, which is where a lot of working class, lower middle class women had gone to drink and have a good time. So instead, nightclubs invited them in. So then they were taken into these like dens of iniquity. And jazz music was incredibly important. There were loads of black musicians that came over from the States. So it was also the first time that there were lots of interracial relationships, which we don't really talk about, isn't really mentioned. So, but certainly that was a really important period for women just saying, maybe we don't need men after all, and like, what's sort of the point?
But also because there weren't the men, women, women again, apparently I've read books, they wouldn't even, and in your book, they wouldn't move class. They'd prefer to stay a spinster than marry someone out of their class. Yeah. And also they did embark on relationships with women as well, discreetly, didn't they, you said?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, the suffragette movement had really shifted the notion of not so much a good woman, because the suffragette's quite moralistic, certainly about sex, but it had certainly opened up a debate about the possibilities of life as a woman. So there was a large conversation going on about how you prevented yourself from getting pregnant, and there were all sorts of different methods suggested. There was this movement called Dianonism, which was basically non-penetrative sex lovemaking. And some of
the, that's quite nice.
Yeah, and they sort of packaged it as a very sensual, pleasurable activity, but it was really just
everything but.
It was everything but, and they were trying to find a way to encourage women and to kind of get men to agree to it too, which I don't think was that successful.
No, because men want the final.
Of course, but in the 20s. Mary Stopes' book Married Love was so influential, it is unbelievable. It sold an insane amount of copies, and it was really single women that were taking tips from it as well as married ones, because it was really about how to stop yourself from getting pregnant.
Yeah, she was the first woman, wasn't she, interested in birth control,
yeah,
for real people. Yeah.
Well, she set up a clinic in London that was for working class women.
There was one in Soho I used to go to. It's closed down now. It's off Soho Square.
It's so fascinating. Yeah. But the other thing about it is that she was virulently against abortion, so I find it kind of ironic that, you know, our main abortion clinics carry her name. But that just tells you how, you know, notions of acceptable sexual behaviour and reproductive rights do change from, you know, decade to decade.
Exactly. I was very intrigued in your book to find out about the voluntary women. What was their job? What were they doing on the streets?
Yeah, so after, around the time of the First World War, young women were apparently struck down with this thing called khaki fever. And when I say young, I mean very young, like 13, 14, 15, 16. And these were girls that sort of wanted to get up in the war effort but couldn't.
I bet.
And they instead were kind of groupies to the soldiers that were flocking, you know, not just the streets, but smaller towns and setting up camps, places like Grantham. And so there were two groups who had their roots in the suffragettes, the Voluntary Women's Patrol and the Women's Police, I think they were called. And they basically were encouraged to police sexual behaviour of women. So they would, and they had permission from one of the groups had permission from the police to make arrests, and the other group were sort of older women in their 30s, 40s, 50s who would literally drag people out of bushes or go around to people's houses and empty them out of, you know, misbehaving soldiers' wives and things.
But how bad was it? I mean, was there a need for this? I mean, was it just moralistic? What, I don't get what they're...
Yeah, well, it was a combination. I think, you know, the interesting thing about the suffragettes' main slogan, Votes for Women, is that it was actually followed up by a second part, Chastity for Men, but we don't ever talk about that. And
what, because men were quite rampant, more, you know, abusing women?
Yeah, I mean, it came from, you know, it came from the idea that women, yeah, did need protecting to some extent and didn't just need to be the sex objects of men or the toys of men. But what happened is during the First World War, the government was obsessed with venereal disease and that kind of killing off half the troops in the trenches. So part of the role of these women's patrols was to stop the spread of STIs.
Wow. So interesting. I mean, it's just something you never hear about.
No, it's completely fascinating.
And tell me, Nikki, how did you uncover it all?
Old-fashioned research. I had the idea for the book. Hadn't really thought in too much detail how I would dig up the information. I presume that most of it would be there, that feminist academics and social historians would have extracted this information already. But when I arrived in the British Library and started to dig through material, it became apparent they hadn't. And so I'm no historian, even though I did, you know, history as part of my degree. I had to find my own primary sources and start to kind of sift through letters and diary entries and lots of magazines. Women's magazines were an incredible source for this book.
Because every book or magazine that's been printed in Britain is in the library, isn't it?
Yeah, they have a copy of everything. It can be difficult to start off with if you don't know what you're looking for.
Yeah, where do you start? Didn't you kind of slightly panic at the beginning?
I did, but I was lucky in that when I studied my degree, which was in English, it was a sort of historical approach. So I'd had quite a broad brush historical social education. So there weren't too many gaps, basic gaps that I had to fill in. But there were some periods which I knew nothing about. I didn't really know anything about Edwardian England. I didn't know anything about the 1930s. So when I was writing each chapter, the first thing I would do would be to find a really good history of the period and get a sense of the era in which I was writing. And then it was just a case of reading as much as possible and sifting through things very quickly, you know. And for that, I'm glad of a combination of the rigorous academic education that I had, but then also having worked as a journalist for so many years and being able to try to get to the point very quickly. It'd be interesting to think what a proper historian thought about the book. You know, it's very much popular history, but I hope it's accurate. I've tried as hard as possible.
I find it's just with so much information on each page. It's like a lot. It's fantastic. There's so much to digest. You know what I mean? You could even read like two pages a day and think about what's on it. You know what I mean?
Definitely. And I think we could have. We were on, you know, the usual thing with writing books, on an incredibly tight deadline, and it might have been nicer to sort of let it air a little bit. But it was kind of like once I was on a roll, I couldn't stop digging things up. And it just seemed, everything seemed so fascinating to me. I just became totally engrossed in the project.
So tell me about you, Nikki. You are the director of the Ethical Porn Partnership. Can you explain what that means? Because I don't really understand.
Yeah, so the Ethical Porn Partnership is a movement, a collective of people that want to produce porn to a set of agreed standards. So a bit like the Soil Association, a bit like Fair Trade, the idea is to create a stamp for it so that we know the performers haven't been coerced, that they're of, you know, the right age, that they've had health testing, that they have psychological, emotional support on set. And the idea was really to kind of just create a better product, because having written about sex and relationships for, you know, a good 8 years now, and having sort of interviewed and researched around the porn industry in LA, and having, you know, been an absolute, you know, designated feminist, when I started to kind of marry those things, what was becoming apparent to me is that women are incredibly poorly served by the porn industry. And I don't just mean in terms of how they're treated on set, because actually a lot of them are treated very well, but I mean in terms of content, how much artistic control they get over their material, how it's distributed around the world, and what rights they have to their image being used, and also just in terms of how we serve female fantasy.
Because it is the film business, isn't it? It is a different film business, but it is the same thing. So why can't these people be kind of stars in their own right and make money? Why should just the production company make money?
No, absolutely. And I think the other thing is that many of the women that are coming through as performers now are incredibly well-educated, very socially savvy, very interested in feminism and women's rights. You know, there's a number of them that have women's studies backgrounds, and they see pornography as kind of the last bastion of, you know, male dominance. They want their idea isn't just to kind of, you know, the traditional feminist idea has always been to kind of ban it or ignore it, but their idea is that they want to take it on and reshape it a little bit, like the way women have done with the tech industry. And tech and porn are very entwined.
Yes, so the tech, that's where you find it.
Absolutely. Yeah. So the people that are coming up with technological innovations in pornography and also pleasure products are very much forward thinking and thinking about creating something that's sort of utopian and an object or an experience that will improve people's understanding of themselves.
To be honest, what I'd like to see is porn that I want to see, what is made for a man who, I'm not being rude, but they have lower standards than us. I want to see something pretty, I want to see something a little bit romantic, I want to see something with a good script. I really want to be taken there in a beautiful way. Why can't we be, you know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And there are some women coming through that are making that kind of content. Erica Lust is a really brilliant director who works in Europe. There's the Crash Pad series, which is for women that wouldn't consider themselves straight. And the other thing that's happening now is this kind of wave of cam performance. So webcamming was always kind of seen as the most low-rent aspect of the porn industry.
Was that kind of live then?
Yeah, and now because we're all becoming so obsessed with video, it's actually moving up the scale, and lots of mainstream studios are shutting down and realising that they actually only need to sell very short clips to make money.
What, but made on an iPhone? Sort
of, yeah, thing. Absolutely. So what a new generation of women are doing, they're thinking, well, how can I really control my image and my performance? Well, I could do that if I stream it. And so they're doing some amazingly creative things, and being able to bring in, the other thing they're able to do is they're able to test, you know, live if what they're doing works for the audience, because if you're doing something that isn't enticing to people, they literally just leave your chat room. So it's kind of a bit of a sex lab for them. Their work, the other thing that's really fascinating is that some of the most mainstream porn stars are now actually moving into camming on their own websites and putting money into sharing their streams with other performers. So it's actually...
They're taking the power away from the big boys. Yeah.
They're taking the power away, and it's actually minorly radical, I think. So
it's very exciting.
It's entirely positive. And yeah. I think some of them are now linking up with these female-owned pleasure product companies, these kind of San Franciscan tech goddesses that are making these amazing devices that you can use with partners in other countries and this kind of thing. So I really see this being the right time for women to challenge the mainstream porn industry, the mainstream sex industry.
It's so exciting, yeah. Nikki, it's great.
And so the Ethical Porn Partnership is attached to that. You know, I really want to celebrate these people that are making this kind of status quo shifting content. So we're, you know, it's in the very early stages and it's a bit of an experiment. And yeah, that, I mean, that's the idea, and we'll just see where it goes.
Fantastic. Now let's just talk finally, because we can't do because you do nearly every decade in the 20th century. But let's just talk about now, because you were saying when you came in, you were saying that people really don't know how to date nowadays. Can you explain that further?
Yeah, we're having a weird sort of dating crisis, or a dating etiquette crisis, I think. What I found so fascinating about writing this history of dating is that up until fairly recently, people had carefully scripted codes by which to go about their dating behaviour. And the other thing is that until the 60s, first dates often met at home, at a parent's home. You know, it was very common for someone to come pick you up from your house and come in and say hello to your mum and dad.
That's true.
And what we have now is this complete lack of accountability, you know, with apps, that you just meet people you know nothing about, you don't know where they work, you don't know who else they've had relationships with or what their backstory is. And it's making people mistrustful, it's making people jump ship really quickly. And we also have this problem of the paradox of choice, that there just are too many options on apps. So people find a little thing that they don't like about someone and they immediately go back on the app and find somebody else, which really isn't the way to deal with human
beings. Not getting to know somebody. Yeah.
No, exactly. So what I hear when I'm doing my research, when I'm doing my work, when I'm giving talks, is that people are desperate for rules around dating. They want to be told what to do. So, you know, I'm
hoping... Can there be rules nowadays?
Yeah, there absolutely can be rules. But the rules should be on things like, you know, mutual appreciation and respect and politeness and courtesy. And, you know, actually things that were very popular in the Regency era. So I think we could learn a lot from the past in this regard. It's funny how when we talk about relationships and dating, we're always so future forward. But in every other industry or every other kind of, you know, social experiment we have, we look to history to give us some lessons about it. So, you know, why can't we do the same now?
Fantastic. So, if people want to buy your book, it's called The Curious History of Dating, and it's published by Little Brown, and it's out now. Thank you so much, Nikki, for coming on to Radio Gorgeous.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.